the week of August 8th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 66, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And at the GameStop on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where I'm 27th in line, I'm Michael Gills.
What are you doing at a GameStop? That's obviously a video game store here in the United States, but what are you doing there?
Madden 11, the biggest video game franchise of all time, has a new one coming out on Tuesday. And no matter what movie opens this weekend, Madden 11 will gross more this week. It's been grossing like $100 million its first week, so this is a huge event. Nothing is bigger.
Not even an iPhone?
A new iPhone coming out would be bigger, but nothing that's going to happen this week will be bigger. It's literally approaching a $2 billion franchise. It's huge.
Do you play video games?
No.
Good thing you're at GameStop then.
Yeah, that's right. I'm just scared of video games. I'm afraid if I start, I'll never stop.
That's the way I am with them. I have an Xbox, but not an Xbox 360, because I'm afraid to buy the Xbox 360 lest I get sucked into it. But soon you'll be able to play video games in 3D, and we're going to get a little multidimensional in today's episode as we discuss the downturn in 3D movies at the box office. Ben Again. Fritz, a reporter with the Los Angeles Times, will join us to fill us in on why 3D films are earning less these days. We'll also be joined by Patrick Goldstein, a columnist also with the LA Times, who will give us his opinion on why audiences are shunning the new format. There's been a few minor updates to the American Idol judge situation, and we'll bring you up to speed before we move on to music. And in music, the popular Arcade Fire celebrated the release of their latest album, The Suburbs, by webcasting their Madison Square Garden concert on YouTube. Making the event even more special, Terry Gilliam of Monty Python directed the webcast. We'll review some of the responses to the album and the webcast. Of course, our kickers will come in the form of Big Deal or Big Whoop, our lightning round in which we cover the week's top entertainment news stories, and we'll end with a little inside baseball about Tom Cruise. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on this past weekend's box office.
Well, the number one movie of the week stars New York Yankee shortstop Derek Jeter, future Hall of Famer. His film, The Other Guys, debuted at $35.6 million. It also starred, apparently, Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg, but nobody in New York cares about that. It's right in line with other Will Ferrell movies. Number two is Inception, which grossed $18.6 million. It's at $227 million in the U.S., another $250 million overseas, so it's looking at almost $500 million worldwide and counting. Step Up 3D missed a beat. I don't know if I should say that. Step Up 3D grossed $15.5 million, lower than the first and second film in the franchise. Salt was at number four. It's grossed $11 million and is slowly approaching $100 million in the U.S. Dinner for Schmucks was at number five. It fell hard, almost 55%. It's down to $10 million this weekend and $46 million total. Despicable Me, definitely one of the big blockbusters of the year. That's at $209 million and counting. Cats and Dogs, Revenge of Kitty Galore is a flop. It's at $26 million total and fading fast. Zac Efron's weepy Charlie St. Cloud, also not doing great. That's at $23 million total. Toy Story 3 is about to hit $400 million in the U.S., about to hit $500 million overseas. It's the biggest Pixar film of all time, and its total is now about $900 million. And at number 10, the indie film, if you can call a film starring such big stars as Annette Bening a indie film, The Kids Are All Right, is at $2.6 million. It's $14 million total, definitely making it one of the smaller success stories of the year. I didn't see anything this weekend. I was watching the Yankees play Boston, where Derek Jeter passed Babe Ruth on the all-time hits list. What were you guys doing?
I went to the Teen Choice Awards because that's the way
you?
I roll. Yes.
No. How was it?
It was very teeny bopper-esque.
How surprising.
I felt very old. At the end, I went to the concession stand or the souvenir stand to look for my cane. I wanted to purchase a wheelchair or something that was going to get me home through the maddening crowd of
17-year-old, 14-year-old girls.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Frightening.
Was it fun?
Yeah.
Or did you just feel out of place?
I felt a little out of place.
What about you, Karen?
I walked out of Step Up 3.
Oh, is it that bad?
I'm sorry. Excuse me. That's Step Up 3D to you?
No, it wasn't. It was Step Up 3 because I didn't see it in 3D.
Ooh.
I couldn't even find a 2D theater. Wow, good for you.
This was quite possibly one of the worst movies ever made. It was awful, and I loved Step Up 1 and 2. I mean, I can get in touch with my inner cheese ball pretty easily. But this was just like bad acting, dancing, bad acting, dancing, bad actors kissing, dancing. It was awful. I was, after 15 minutes, I knew I was going to hate this movie, but I gave it another 20 and I was just, I'm done.
If it wasn't for you, this movie would have grossed $8 million this weekend.
Well, either way, it didn't gross as much as Step Up 1 or 2 in their debuts. And certainly with the 3D surcharge being accounted for, fewer people saw Step Up 3D than saw either Step Up 1 or 2 in its opening frame.
You know, looking at the list of movies, though, the Will Ferrell movie, which starred Derek Jeter of the New York Yankees.
Okay, we got that.
I love Derek Jeter. Will Ferrell is not a movie star in this world. He's a movie star in the U.S., but if you look at his list of movies, his movies gross almost nothing overseas. It's fascinating. Like $5 million, $10 million, $12 million. Really, really low grosses overseas. He is not a draw overseas. The only movies of his that have drawn overseas are with some other big star like Ben Stiller and Starsky and Hutch. So, you know, he's money in the bank for a movie where, you know, you can make back what you need in the U.S., but for a franchise or a big movie like Land of the Lost, not only was that a flop, it was even more of a flop because he does not draw audiences around the world.
Well, his biggest film was Talladega Nights.
Exactly.
Which made, I guess, in the U.S., it made close to $148 million.
And just another $20 million in the rest of the world.
Right.
$20 million. Mind you, that's about NASCAR. And, you know, Blades of Glory, another movie of his that made like $15 million overseas. That made over $100 million in the U.S. But go down up and down his list, and he draws nothing in the rest of the world. I don't think they even know who he is. They've never heard of him. So is he a movie star? No, I don't think he is, because you got to draw people worldwide. Angelina Jolie, on the other hand, her movie, disastrously reviewed, terribly received, and she's still going to drag it to $100 million in the U.S. and probably $200 million worldwide, if not more. And that, to me, is a movie star. When everything goes wrong, you won't lose your shirt, because they will draw in enough people no matter what.
Well, this weekend, Salt, starring Angelina Jolie, made $16.9 million overseas and is already at $62.8 million total internationally.
Yeah, and it's just getting going, right?
Right. And Despicable Me is doing well internationally, $43.5 million. But, you know, frankly, Will Ferrell not doing well overseas, that's quite common for comedies. A lot of comedy films don't play well overseas.
How does Adam Sandler do?
Adam Sandler is much better than I think most comics. I mean, if you look at his last few movies, Bedtime Stories, that bad family film that grossed, you know, $110 million in the U.S., $218 million worldwide. The Zohan, that grossed another $100 million overseas. And even I Now Pronounce You Truck and Larry pulled like 70% of its gross overseas. Click, that also did well. So he's not doubling the gross, which is the least you should do overseas. But he can be a draw. Though obviously, again, like Sperling says, comedy does not travel as well as most other genres.
Well, Inception's playing well overseas. This weekend marked the first weekend where the box office was bigger overseas than it was here in the United States. And so I guess it's overseas depending on where you are. It generated $46.6 million in 58 markets. And I guess we're down in the $18 million range here with Inception in North America. So first week after 4 weeks that Inception is out of first place.
This is a movie that people love to argue and discuss and think about. And that's why it's grossing so much, even during the weekdays. I mean, everybody wants to see this movie. Even my mom's going to go see it.
Well, why don't we get Ben Fritz and Patrick Goldstein on from the Los Angeles Times, and they can tell us why maybe Step Up 3D and Cats and Dogs, all these 3D movies, aren't doing well these days. Ben Fritz, we've spoken to before about video games, and he's a reporter who covers the box office beat as well. Welcome, Ben.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And somebody that you hear us mention every single week, if not once, then twice, or maybe a dozen or two times, Patrick Goldstein, a columnist for the LA Times. The Big Picture is his column. Patrick, thank you very much for joining us.
Much appreciated.
Now, Ben, one of the stories that broke this week, broke kind of all over the entertainment press, was that the 3D box office is down. Why is it down and how is it down?
I mean, all you can really say is two things. One, there have been several 3D movies recently that have not done well at the box office or outright bombed. This past weekend, we had Step Up 3D, which did 15 point something, which is not very good. The weekend before that was Cats and Dogs, which was terrible. I believe it did like $11 or $12 million. So you've had several movies that mainly show that just because you're 3D doesn't mean you're going to be a hit. And the other thing is you're seeing generally movies do a little bit less a percentage of their box office than they used to in 3D. Back when the technology was new and there weren't as many movies coming out, you would see movies like Avatar doing eventually more than 80% of their box office in 3D, and that was pretty common. And now it's more common. You could see 50%, you know, for recent movies like Airbender and Despicable Me. Partially, I think, because people are being a little more discriminating, it seems like, about what they want to see in 3D. And secondly, as there's more movies in theaters, you know, then the number of 3D screens available becomes more competitive. So a new movie might not have as many 3D screens to itself compared to Avatar. There were no other 3D movies out. So like Despicable Me opening weekend did less than half its business in 3D. On the other hand, this weekend, Step Up did, I think, 84% of its box office in 3D. So people decided, the few people who wanted to see that movie said they want to see it in 3D. So it's, there's no definite rules, but in general, we've learned, you know, 3D does not guarantee a hit, and not everybody wants to see every movie in 3D.
Yeah, of course, Alfred Hitchcock said that actors were cattle, but as Patrick Goldstein said, audiences aren't cattle. I hear people complaining all the time about wearing the glasses and how families are annoyed that every single family film seems to be in 3D. Do you think it is a question of just not enough 3D screens and competition for them, or are audiences actually saying, you know what, I don't feel like I want to pay an extra $3 surcharge to see a movie in 3D every other week? Is that what you think is happening, Patrick?
Well, yeah, I think there's definitely that's at work. You know, Avatar really set the bar pretty high. And I think audiences thought, wow, if this is 3D, then I'm in for more. And the problem is, after Avatar, it's been like a law of diminishing returns. I guess the high end of the scale being Avatar, the low end being Clash of the Titans, which was awful. I mean, it was just dingy and dark, and the movie wasn't very good to start with, and 3D made it worse. And so it costs more money. You know, this is a big cash cow for the studios, and I think consumers are at some point, even though I think movies are really good buy and are very fairly priced in today's culture, but at some point, you know, you go, where's the added value? Especially with these animated movies, I talk to tons of parents whose kids don't like it. They don't get a lot out of the 3D. They think the glasses are either uncomfortable or give them headaches. So I think they've just got a lot of areas where if the quality isn't being delivered, you're going, why am I paying the extra $4 or $5?
Well, now, Ben, how is this extra $3 or $4 affecting the box office returns for such movies as Step Up 3D? It's giving them kind of a little boost, making it seem as if they're successful, but not as many people are seeing them. Is that correct?
Well, it may make it look to the average person like more people are seeing it, which is not true. Yes, it gives it an artificial boost in terms of where it ranks in the box office chart. On the other hand, money is money, and the studios and the theaters couldn't care less whether two people come and pay $8 or one person comes and pays $16, right? So the money is the money, but yes, it is true. If two movies have, you know, $15 million this weekend and one was 3D and one wasn't, the one that was 3D had a lot fewer people who came to see it.
Well, now, is that true that studios don't care whether two people saw it or one person saw it, so long as they make the same amount of money? Because really, isn't it all about trying to get to the DVD? And if 10 people saw the film, well, then you have a shot at selling maybe 8 or 9 DVDs.
Well, there's some truth to that. Just because the people who buy the DVDs aren't necessarily the same people who saw the movies. So that would be an interesting study. I actually don't know the answer as to whether or not the box office to DVD conversion of a 3D movie is different than for a 2D movie. I actually don't know the answer to that. That's a good question. I mean, yes, I will withdraw a little bit. I think theoretically a studio would rather the most people see their movie possible. That can only have benefits for them, of course. But it's not like the extra, what I'm saying is, it's not like the extra money doesn't matter. It's not like that surcharge is a fake and doesn't count. It's still money. It's still actual money in their pockets.
You know, Ben raises an interesting question there. Everything at the movies is about buzz. So if the buzz gets around that the movie is not worth the price of admission, whether it's because of the 3D or because of 3D factors just thrown into the audience's general attitude about a film, you know, we still don't have 3D on the DVD side. So you wonder if by the way this is working out, if people are going to feel like they're getting even less value if they bought the DVD. So the DVD sales for a bad 3D movie would be even worse than if it just come out in 2D.
Oh, that's an interesting concept, actually, when you think about it. I mean, I don't think, other than Avatar, we have a lot of data on movies that were released in 3D and then were subsequently released on DVD or Blu-ray. I guess we have Avatar and Alice in Wonderland. I don't know if those are the best examples to go by.
Yeah, I think it'll. I think we're going to have to see it play out with some of the movies that have been coming through the pipeline over the last 6 months. But I would, you know, I think that would be something worth watching when we can get our DVD numbers together.
It certainly is true, generally speaking, that as the DVD market continues to shrink and box office revenue has actually been on the rise, partially because of 3D in the past year or two, the economic mix of a studio for how they make money is shifting. I mean, DVD is still a majority, but it's definitely shifting where the theatrical revenue is becoming more important and the home entertainment revenue is becoming less important.
On the other hand, Ben, I heard that Disney has decided to hold off on converting some of its classic animated films like Beauty and the Beast into 3D so that they can pump it out on DVD because they're not ready with home screen televisions that can handle 3D, yep. And the glasses don't work great at home right now if you have a regular TV, and the cost of converting it's pretty high. So
yeah,
they're holding off a bit on that.
That would make sense because you would think re-releasing a classic animated film like that in theaters, the main reason to do it is to generate awareness of the film with a new generation of kids, and hopefully they'll all tell mom and dad they want the DVD. So if you're going to show it in 3D in the theater, it makes sense perhaps to be able to provide them with that same experience at home if possible.
Well, and I think that they actually have it converted already. However, they are holding off on releasing it because they know that the follow-up DVD and Blu-ray release won't be able to be viewed in 3D at home. So
right.
It's really just a timing thing. How do you think, Patrick, the home audience or the home viewing experience will affect 3D films at the theater? Or will it not?
You know, the real impact at home is going to be with sports, not with movies. I think because sports fans are always early adopters, they love to get the technology, they love to pay hideous amounts of money for their, you know, NFL packages and their MLB packages. They're the ones that are going to invest the money in 3D. And I have to admit, one day early on, I went and made the rounds of all the 3D houses and looked at their reels. And they showed me not just scenes from movies, but they showed me scenes from sporting events. And I think that's where there's a real potential application for this, both, you know, monetarily and creatively. A football game looks great in 3D. It is a sport that really lends itself to that deep focus that you get in 3D. And I think it only adds to the kind of visceral excitement. So I think that's where we're going to see maybe bigger leaps and bounds in home entertainment than in movies for a while.
I have a way to solve Hollywood's problem, which they will not accept. Don't charge extra for 3D. They don't charge extra for stadium seating because that brings people in and makes them happier. They don't charge for nice digital projections. They don't charge for good sound. They don't charge for color or dialogue, and they shouldn't charge for 3D. That way, any studio that was just trying to cash in a quick buck wouldn't bother if they're not going to be able to charge extra for it. Only movies that deserve or need to be in 3D would be shown in 3D. And audiences like me, instead of avoiding the big screens where they're showing their 3D movies and trying to find it in 2D, avoiding the biggest screen that the multiplex has going, the nicest spot, I'm running to the smallest screen to get it for $3 cheaper. I'd be flocking back to the big ones to see movies in 3D.
Well, I like that about you, that you're a crazed idealist that Hollywood even in a million years would do that kind of pricing. But look, what's going to be really fascinating for us to watch next year, both on the business side with Ben and me on the wearing my columnist cap, you know, I've been reading there's something like 28 or 29 3D movies that are coming next year. That's one every other week. That's going to put an insane amount of stress and pressure on the marketplace, no matter how many new, you know, theaters are equipped to show them. That's way too many movies. I think that's going to show a much more dramatic sense of what's going to happen. And I think there are going to be a lot of movies that are going to fall by the wayside.
What would happen, Ben? Do you think people or studios would continue to make 3D films, or would they back off this 3D trend?
If they see a lot of 3D movies flop, then they're going to, you know, they're definitely going to be more selective. I think you'll, as with all trends, first it starts working. Everybody says, let's do everything. And then they start saying, well, let's be selective about when we do it and when we don't. Because don't forget, making a movie in 3D, just converting it costs something like $10 million on average per picture. And if you want to shoot it in 3D, I don't know exactly how much it is, but it's more because you have to not only have more equipment on set, but it takes longer for the shooting. Everything's more complicated. So you have to, you know, if you see 3D movies that are not performing better than they would in 2D, studios are going to start thinking, is it worth this investment? And they're going to find out in later this year and next year. just how often it's worth the investment and how often it isn't.
Well, and what do you make of the fact that James Cameron, of course, announced that he is not only re-releasing Avatar on August 27th, but more to the point, he's re-releasing Titanic. He's converting Titanic, which is taking, I guess, the better part of a year, about 10 months. If that fails, will that be the end of going back into the archives to pull out blockbusters that could be turned into 3D?
Well, no. I mean, I think it'll be a fascinating test case, and everyone will be watching it because he's the high-end guy. And if it doesn't work for him, then it probably wouldn't work for anyone. And if it does work for him, then I think it'll encourage, you know, Disney or some other people to try going back into the archives. But, you know, I think what this tells us over and over is 3D will work for the big, you know, mega movies that everyone feels the need to see. It's going to work for the Toy Stories. I just don't know if it's going to work for the Fright Nights. I think that it'll be the smaller, you know, less desirable movies that'll get picked off first before the big ones.
Well, Ben Fritz, Patrick Goldstein of the Los Angeles Times, thank you very much for joining us. Ben, your writing can be found all over the Los Angeles Times in the company town section as well as in the calendar section. And, of course, everyone should follow you on Twitter. What is your Twitter handle?
It's very complicated. It's Ben Fritz, BenFritz.
And Patrick, I believe you're also on Twitter, but I have to point everybody to your blog, which I know that when you first started, you kind of had some, at least what I was reading, you had some hesitation about it. But from our end, from the reader's end, it's actually provided us with even more Patrick Goldstein than we had before.
Well, I appreciate it. And I'm going to get Ben to tell me the story someday about his experience leaving the Diamond Lane a little too early.
Oh, I see Patrick follows mine, yes. Patrick follows my Twitter account very closely, apparently. I Twittered yesterday about how I pulled out of the carpool lane too early, and I got a ticket for $465.
Oh,
which is so
my
great.
God.
Even for a print journalist is a lot of money, believe it or not.
That's more money than they'll ever charge for a 3D movie, too.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, that was good of print journalists. They should throw that in our faces, Ben Fritz and Patrick Goldstein, to talk to us. But I have to say, I wasn't being idealistic when I talked about studios not charging extra for 3D. Hollywood has a history of trying to create lavish, exciting things going on in movie theaters that you can't reproduce at home. Panavision, Sensoround, from the silly to the important color, sound. You know, all these things came along, stadium seating. You know, 3D should just be another thing that they give you to keep you happy about going to the movies, because that powers everything, DVD, cable, the whole schlamilla.
Well, I wonder if by the time James Cameron works his magic and comes up with the Avatar sequels, which in his, I guess, interviews, he was doing phoner interviews with certain journalists all week, and he announced not only is he going to do a sequel, he plans to do two sequels, he may shoot them back to back, but he's also going to write a novelization of Avatar.
Yeah, he said he's pounding that out, which doesn't sound very promising, but it's supposed to come out towards the end of the year.
Do you think he's a better novelist than screenwriter?
Oh, he's a terrible writer.
How could he be a novelist? Yeah, he can't write dialogue, so a novel just seems stunning, but we'll see. More power to him.
I wonder, though, if all of this 3D hoo-ha will be kind of over or will have run its course and then kind of a new wave will begin with the Avatar sequels, which I'm sure are 3 or 4 years away.
3D is not the problem. Increasing ticket prices by 30-40% for most of America is the problem.
I agree.
Well, no matter how much they charge for a Justin Bieber 3D movie, I'm pretty
oh,
sure.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
baby.
Well, as we were recording last week's episode, Paramount Pictures announced that they were going to do a Justin Bieber movie in 3D. It will be about his life story. So it's going to be about
so far.
Yeah, it's going to be about 15 minutes. So.
Well, I love it because there's another story that he's got a book coming to the bookstores called Justin Bieber, First Step to Forever, My Story, that HarperCollins is putting out. And when is it hitting stores? I'm not sure. I'll have to look that up.
Sometime later this year.
Sometimes probably in time for the Christmas giving season. And it was presented as a photographic memoir. And the next day, Justin tweeted and said, it's not a memoir. You know, clearly I'm not old enough yet to have a, you know, write my own memoir. Ha ha. I'm like, yeah, but you got a whole movie about your life coming out.
Well, I'm sure it's just going to be a concert film. It's going to be released February 11th, 2011, just in time for Valentine's Day weekend. And
but it's being billed as a biopic, not as a concert film. That's what I find really intriguing.
Is that a mistake? Yeah. Do you think?
No.
It just sounds like it's more than just a concert film.
Okay.
And that he's playing himself. So if it was a concert, just a concert movie, I mean, of course he'd be playing himself. He is himself. But this is going to be more than a concert documentary.
Well, on Twitter, Justin Bieber said, quote, "Next Valentine's, we are," and the letter R, "coming with a major 3D movie telling the story with an Oscar-winning director and also filming the tour at MSG in New York City!" And that Oscar-winning director was Davis Guggenheim, and you might remember him from winning an Oscar for An Inconvenient Truth, the Al Gore film about the environment. But it turns out Mr. Guggenheim is not directing the film. He's a little too busy. And I'm sure he's found himself to be a little too busy after he found out who Justin Bieber was.
By the way, what 16-year-old says Oscar-winning director without being told to say Oscar-winning director?
I have no
idea. I'm sure Davis Guggenheim was busy because he was mentioned to it, but he just wasn't able to work it out in his schedule. But I'm sure he'd be happy to work with Justin. Why wouldn't he?
Well, you know who else might be busy? A little too busy to maybe be a judge on American Idol. Because he's on tour, as a matter of fact, not making a 3D movie about his life, although that 3D movie could be interesting.
Yes.
Steven Tyler of Aerosmith. He apparently was approached by 20th Century Fox, or I should say Fox Network, the Fox Network.
Or you should just say a Fox.
Somebody who nobody knows, because he said that some pretty woman came and asked him. And what everybody's saying is, well, they're... are no pretty women that would have asked you. They're both men. The two, you know,
they're all ugly people who work at Fox.
No, that's not. They're saying they were all men that would have approached you. So we don't know who would have offered you that role as a judge on American Idol. But he said that it was offered to him, and he said it during a radio interview on Monday, and that he's kind of going through the negotiations, but that he doesn't know if he's going to be able to do it because he's on tour.
Well, couldn't it have been Dana Walden that approached him? I mean, I don't know what her exact title is, but she's up there and she's gorgeous.
Yeah. And ironically, of course, he was almost not on the tour because he was having personal issues, a.k.a. drugs, and the band had enough of him and said he was gone and they were going to get another singer. So he would have had all the time in the world to be on Idol, but they all passed
up. Or he could have pretended he was going to be a judge in order to get his band members to panic.
But no, that happened long ago. Long before this.
Yeah, they panicked when they saw the number of prescription bottles in his dressing room.
But Sperling, read his quote about being a judge and how he would judge contestants.
He says, "I would be honest to the ones that think they have it, and I would be truthful in the sense that if, to those that have it, they don't have it yet enough, and I would tell them exactly why as I see it." Now, if you can actually understand that...
And that's why he shouldn't be a judge on American Idol.
What? I mean, he would become the Paula Abdul of the show. Because he's like Yogi Berra. Who can understand that?
Yeah, that was bad.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you have to know who Yogi Berra is for that to make any sense whatsoever.
Well, but who doesn't know who Yogi Berra? Oh, what am I talking about?
Yogi Berra. No.
People
Yogi
who
Berra.
Love Justin Bieber. Yeah. No idea who Yogi Berra is. Speaking of Yogi Berra, did you guys see the one sheet?
Yes.
Oh,
okay. For Yogi Berra in 3D.
Yeah, but it's like something about... what is it? Yogi's behind Boo Boo, and he looks like really excited. And then the tagline is something like "Good things come to bears." It's something really awful and sexual. And then right underneath that, "Coming soon."
and when you Google that, you get Yogi Bear poster, sexual or not?
Oh, no.
Yeah, great things come in bears.
That's what it is. Oh, God,
coming soon. He does look happy, and you're all dirty, dirty, dirty minded. So it makes no sense. Come in bears. What?
Not to get us off the dirty Yogi Bear poster story. American Idol. It looks like Jennifer Lopez is in, right? I mean, that hasn't yet been confirmed.
But I think it's pretty definite.
There's some talk about Jimmy Iovine, or is it Jimmy Iovine?
It's Iovine, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah. In other names that I can mispronounce.
He'd be great.
Yeah, he would be great. Now, we should explain who he is. Karen, why don't you fill us in?
He is the head of Interscope Records.
That's right. He's worked with a ton of different talent, including
Eminem and Gwen Stefani.
Yeah, I mean, it would be very interesting to see a personality like his. Jimmy, how do you pronounce his last name?
Iovine. But basically, we're talking about everybody's publicist wants to get their name out there as being considered, and Idol wants to make it look like they've got every celebrity in the world sort of angling to get in it. So we've had like 20, 30 different names thrown out there as just sort of fodder.
I think Guy Osiri would be fascinating.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Maverick Records? Yeah, it would be great.
Yeah, I mean, of course, he's now managing Madonna. But I hired a publicist just so that I could fire them when they didn't put me up for
Idol. There you go.
Yeah.
Really?
Go.
Gosh. Yeah. That's a great idea. That's $5,000 down the tubes right there.
Well, what's the music news, since Idol is obviously a huge influence on the musical charts?
Well, a group that never appeared on American Idol and probably never will, Arcade Fire, released their third album this past week, and it will likely overtake Avenged Sevenfold in the album charts this week. Avenged Sevenfold beat out Eminem, but barely, by 4,000 units. So Eminem, after, I guess, 5 weeks up at the top of the album charts, Billboard reports, no, Avenged Sevenfold, in their first week, their album Nightmare sold 163,000 copies, beating out Eminem's 159,000. And I bet you, I would put money down that Arcade Fire will sell the most albums this week, or I guess it's last week, the way Billboard works. But in their debut week, they will probably come in number one. And they were in the news quite a bit, weren't they?
With their show at Madison Square Garden and their webcasting?
Yes.
I thought that video that we're going to put in the show notes is pretty entertaining.
Okay, now what you're referring to, Karen, do you want to fill us in?
Well, it's like behind the scenes of Terry Gilliam about to direct them going on stage, I guess. I mean, they're robots. I mean, it's kind of tough to explain, but Andrew Garfield, who's going to be the new Spider-Man, is awfully cute in it.
Well, yeah, and actually it made me go, oh, maybe he could play Spider-Man. But it was effectively, you're right, Karen, it was 10 minutes that was put before Arcade Fire took the stage, and it kind of led up to them taking the stage during the webcast. And it was a comedy skit, much the way, I guess, Monty Python. It wasn't Monty Python-esque, but it was definitely offbeat. You know, it begins with Mr. Gilliam talking about how he was hired to do the show. And then it ends with Terry Gilliam and Andrew Garfield trying to start, if you will, Arcade Fire, because technically they're all just robots at Terry Gilliam's control.
And I didn't actually think that was really very funny, but I liked watching Terry Gilliam kind of freak out and his little PA and Andrew Garfield kind of hovering around him. I thought that was funny.
Yeah. Now, did either of you see the webcast?
No.
Nope.
So neither of you saw it. I have to say, I watched pretty much the whole thing, and it was spotty at best. I mean, you know, who knows how many people were trying to download it at the same time, but Twitter was going crazy. It was on Vevo, which is a YouTube spinoff for music and music videos, and the quality was good in terms of the video quality and the audio quality, but it was spotty in that it would buffer at times.
I hate that.
And Terry Gilliam was trying to do some weird things. He was kind of superimposing the video that was on stage above the band over what he was shooting, which may work on film, but when you're sitting there watching it through a little box or on full screen, trying to stream it through the internet, it just doesn't look very good. It looks confusing. But what was really cool is you could choose the camera. There were like one or two camera angles that you could choose. That was really neat.
And this is a band who's really sort of built themselves up through critical acclaim and touring. Their last album, Neon Bible, hit number two. And so, you know, they've never even gone gold, I don't think, in the U.S. But they're growing and growing critically and commercially. And so if this album debuts at number one, that'll be a huge step forward for them artistically and commercially. And it's definitely the best reviewed album you know.
Yeah, and the fact that Neon Bible, which was so good, is considered their sophomore slump. I mean, that's saying a lot about this third one.
I know.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, certainly this is a band that, you know, a couple of years ago, 5 years ago, they were riding around in a, you know, broken down van, and now they're headlining Lollapalooza and different festivals throughout Europe. They're being compared to Coldplay, Radiohead, and U2, and having seen them live, I have to say, they are phenomenal. And there are still some clips up from this Madison Square Garden concert that are just fantastic.
So even if concert business in general is down, bands like Arcade Fire can still do it the old-fashioned way and make it work.
Okay, yeah. Now you're moving us on to the story about Live Nation, which is the company that merged with Ticketmaster or bought Ticketmaster. They're together. Okay.
They prop date each other.
Oh,
they married each other, but only in California. Now, Michael, do you want to fill us in on this story?
Well, we've been talking about this for a little while. It's been lower ticket sales all year long for the concert biz, whether it's because of a combination, obviously, of the economy, high ticket prices, big acts not being able to tour. Everything is down. Live Nation, which is by far the biggest one in town, said that they made lower ticket sales public 2 weeks ago, and then they had weak earnings released on last Thursday. Their second quarter earning revenue was $1.2 billion, down almost 10% from last year, which combines the revenue from Live Nation and Ticketmaster, since they didn't get together to this year. And so it's just, you know, more bad news. And, you know, we talked about how maybe the club business was still pretty good, but according to Live Nation CEO Michael Rapino, the bottom line across all business, whether it's a club or an amphitheater, was fewer tickets per show. At the end of the day, it's mostly driven along by bigger shows.
Yeah, and you know, Live Nation is a company that now does these 360 deals where they represent the talent, they sell the merchandise for the talent, they manage the talent, they release the records, and a lot of their talent isn't on tour. Like Kenny Chesney's not on tour. Christina Aguilera's not going to go on tour because she's going to be promoting some movie that looks absolutely god-awful burlesque.
Oh no, I saw the trailer for it before Step Up. It looks so good.
It looks good?
In a bad way or a good way?
It looks so good.
Cher as running a burlesque house, who can't want to see that? But I mean, I like Irving Azoff's quote. He says, "They're going to tour smarter. There are no artists who don't want to charge less for tickets." Well, you know what? It's not that hard.
Speaking of Irving Azoff, did anybody follow his little tweets that came out? And I don't mean little. I don't mean that in any disparaging way. He sent out tweets, but they were very brief in nature for the most part.
Brief for a tweet? You mean like 20 characters instead of 160?
I think he's new. He's new to Twitter, isn't he?
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I started following them once I saw them in the show notes. He's funny. He's just a broadcaster. He just wants to get out messages.
Well, his first tweet, or at least his first in a long while, was blaming music fans for downloading music illegally. And that's the reason that concert ticket prices are so high. And then, I guess, Perez Hilton, the gossip monger? I don't know what we would call him.
Perez Hilton, sorry. Gossip monger extraordinaire, yeah.
Yeah, he must have said something back to Irving Azoff, and then they got into it, Irving Azoff and Perez Hilton. And
I love how he called him a fair-weather...
Christina Aguilera fan.
He called Perez Hilton a fair-weather Christina Aguilera fan. Perez Hilton is a fair-weather fan for everybody. Not like he's got, you know, he has favorites, but, I mean...
He is a fair weather friend.
he then declared Glenn Peoples of Billboard magazine a jerk, which Patrick Goldstein, who joined us earlier, said, "Look, hey, that's actually a badge of honor. Irving Azoff calling you a jerk? Hey, you should wear that with pride."
Exactly.
I mean, the concert industry is kind of a mess. And Irving Azoff on Twitter, Patrick Goldstein said, and we should have asked him about this, but he said, quote, "The great thing about Twitter, as we all know, is that it allows celebrities and showbiz moguls like Azoff to say exactly what they want right off the top of their heads with oh so little self-censorship. The problem with most celebs is that they have so little to say. That is hardly worth the time to follow their tweets. Not so with Azoff," and I highly suggest you follow him because that is very true.
There are actually quite a lot of celebrities that are pretty entertaining to follow.
I have to agree.
Rainn Wilson is awesome.
Yeah, Rainn Wilson is very good. But guess who's coming back?
In the name of love.
Not Michael. No, not Michael at all. It's
Tom Hanks?
Maybe Tom Hanks is coming back, but not on stage. U2 actually posted a video to their YouTube channel. It was shot by Larry Mullen Jr., their drummer, and by the way, their leader. He is the band founder. And it talks about how they're going to come back, and they apologize greatly to all the fans in North America who bought tickets for this summer's tour and weren't able to see the show because Bono got injured. He injured his back and had emergency surgery. And they even went into things like, you know, "We know that you guys made travel plans and it's a big deal. So we really are sorry for causing you so much dismay." And I'm thinking, dude, you were lying on your back after emergency surgery.
We understood.
Yeah. What
you no, I'm sorry. I had plans to see them. I made airline reservations.
Really?
Bono, what are you talking about? Totally kidding. Are you kidding me? I can't even go to concerts. I'm claustrophobic.
Even if it's Lady Gaga?
Especially if it's Lady Gaga.
Well, you know, I just now, actually, I want to try and date her because she has this interview in Vanity Fair where she says, quote, "I have this weird thing that if I sleep with someone, they're going to take my creativity from me through my vagina."
Ew!
Her quote, not mine.
That's where your power lies, Karen.
Yes.
No kidding.
Apparently. But, you know, and more is leaking out about this Vanity Fair interview, including her former drug use, where she said her 82-year-old... Yeah. Well, you know, look, you know.
I think she's just creatively weird. I don't think she's always doing drugs.
Yeah, that's true.
So you're saying that Lady Gaga is not a big deal to you?
I'm saying that sounds like a segue.
I'm saying, before we leave her, that the interesting thing about the YouTube video, and Lady Gaga is probably one of the biggest acts in the world right now, along with YouTube, is that you can tell it was made by them. Not only did Larry Mullen shoot it, but it has like a 40-minute gap at the end of it that's just black screen because they probably didn't know how to edit it. I swear those guys posted it themselves, which I find interesting. It's just a way for them to talk to us.
It was kind of them being real and genuine.
Yeah, they were joking with each other, teasing each other. It was fun.
But Karen, as you mentioned, I was trying to segue into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. And this week, we're going to begin with a little information about Entourage. The gravy train is about to end for the posse of Vincent Chase. The fictional star of HBO's Entourage will be calling it a day after a short final season of 6 episodes in 2011. So his buddies Eric and Drama and Turtle and the rest will need to find some other ways to spend their days. Of course, the show's creator wants to do a feature film because nothing says hit movie like a TV show that has outstayed its welcome and received only a half-assed final season amidst declining ratings. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
At this point, it's just a big whoop because it just petered out. But it is really sort of a big deal. This was a good show.
Michael?
It's a big whoop. I grew bored after one season. But it won. It was up for Emmys 3 years in a row, you know, for best comedy. And, you know, they've had their day. At least they're fading away nicely. But the movie is a dreadful idea.
Speaking of dreadful ideas, Wyclef Jean of the Fugees is running for president of Haiti.
And why is that a bad idea?
I just thought I'd segue into the next question. Like all good politicians, he thinks the rules don't apply to him. You must live in Haiti for 5 consecutive years to run for president. Jean hasn't, but insists that because he was named a roving ambassador for the country, that he deserves a pass. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I say it's a big deal. You know, there's a long history of artists turning to politics. Hello, Ronald Reagan. And Wyclef Jean could be just the person to help Haiti get through its never-ending pain and sorrow.
Wait a second. You had to reach all the way back to Ronald Reagan? Hello, Governor
Arnold Schwarzenegger. Sure, there's a million people. I just wanted to scare you.
Karen?
I think this is a big deal for the same reason, but there was a weird quote that Wyclef Jean said that one reason why he wanted to do this was because I can't keep singing forever.
Yeah.
Why not? Sure you can.
But they've barely done anything as far as a band, the Fugees. They're basically dead.
Maybe they should make it a silent movie. A proposed film about Grateful Dead head Jerry Garcia is facing a tiny problem. His estate and the Dead's production company want nothing to do with it, and insist none of the Dead's music will be available. A Jerry Garcia biopic without the song Truckin'? Bummer, man. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop, and do you own a tie-dyed t-shirt?
No, but I was raised in the Bay Area, and I used to see Jerry Garcia driving around in his red Porsche all the time.
Because, you know, nothing says, you know,
nothing
hippie.
Says, yeah, I'm a slacker deadhead like a red Porsche. big whoop, who cares?
Michael?
It's a big deal for the project because I can't imagine making a movie without the music rights. I just saw the director, Amir Bar-Lev. He's the documentary filmmaker who was going to do this. I just saw his new movie, The Tillman Story, which is really good. A solid documentary about Pat Tillman, the football player who went to Iraq and then died under circumstances that the Bush administration lied about. That's a solid movie. He's a good filmmaker. So it's a shame his project is dead in the water.
Well, now, I don't know if you can make a Jerry Garcia biopic without his music, but can you have Entertainment Tonight without Mary Hart?
No!
Mary Hart is leaving syndicated news magazine Entertainment Tonight after 28 years. The host, known for her smooth on-air delivery, and legs so sexy they were insured for $1 million, has decided she's ready for a change. E.T. is still ranked in the top five for syndicated shows week after week, beating Johnny Come Lately's like Access Hollywood and TMZ. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I picture her my entire life. It's been a long time since I've watched Entertainment Tonight, but she was a pro at her job, and it's the end of an era.
Karen?
I totally agree. It's a huge deal for the same reason.
I have to say, they mentioned her salary as being $5 million last year before the final season.
Yes.
And describing that as this massive salary, that doesn't sound like a lot at all. That sounds perfectly in line for what this cash cow has been over 30 years.
Well, Andrew Wallenstein of the Live Feed blog said that indeed her salary was $5 million. She took a 50% pay cut to do the last year, and that she was effectively pushed out. So you underscored it best. You said it best. You haven't watched it in a while. I haven't watched it in a while. A lot of people haven't watched Entertainment Tonight in a while, and its ratings are down, and it's not making as much money in terms of ad dollars, so people had to take pay cuts.
I prefer Access Hollywood because I like Nancy O'Dell.
I like her, too.
Do you like Rosie O'Donnell?
Sure.
No.
Cutie patootie Rosie O'Donnell is returning to daytime TV. The stand-up comic turned actress enjoyed the biggest success of her career with her daytime talk show, which aired from 1996 to 2002 and garnered O'Donnell 6 straight Emmys for Best Host. Then she came out, joined The View for a tumultuous but ratings-grabbing stint, and toyed with the idea of joining MSNBC for a potential show. Now O'Donnell is joining...
For a political show.
Political show, yes. Now O'Donnell is joining Oprah's new cable network, OWN, with a New York-based chat show. Watch your back, Ellen. You're not the only family-friendly lesbian talk show host anymore. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is a big deal, especially because I really would doubt that her talk show would be family-friendly.
Michael?
I think it's a big deal for OWN. It gives it a lot of legitimacy because there were a lot of networks that would love to have signed Rosie O'Donnell, and they need original content. But I think she said it's going to be a friendly, fun, upbeat show, and that's what she'll deliver. If she wanted to do a political show or an angry show, she would do that. But this is going to be family-friendly.
Wait, so if you admit you're guilty, you don't have to go to jail? That's apparently how it works for Charlie Sheen, the star of 2.5 Men. He pled guilty to assault in connection with a Christmas 2009 domestic dispute involving his wife, Brooke Mueller Sheen. The result? 30 days of rehab, or as Sheen likes to call it, the usual. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
This is very sad. It's a bigger deal as a commentary on our justice system than it is on Charlie Sheen.
Michael?
I don't know if it would be different for anyone else.
I would agree with that.
But I think it's a big whoop. It's just a private thing.
I don't mean because he's a celebrity, although I do think that plays into it. I just don't think that...
Because they don't care enough about assault.
Nobody cares about domestic violence, yeah.
Here's one way to keep your movie's budget down. Get fans to shoot the movie for you. That's what director Ridley Scott did. For his new documentary, Life in a Day, Scott asked people to document their lives on Saturday, July 24th, and send them in via the web. They were deluged with 80,000 shorts from 197 countries and in 45 different languages. Now all they have to do is edit it. Yikes. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop unless the movie's actually good.
Well, it's going to premiere at Sundance in 2011. Karen, what do you think?
I think it's a big deal because if this works, it's going to be a really interesting way of crowdsourcing movie making.
Well, and we should say that Kevin MacDonald, the writer and director for State of Play and Last King of Scotland, is the co-director on that film.
This isn't a model for movie making. It's just a stunt. You can't do it again and again. I think there's very few movies where you could do that.
Sure, you could.
Don't tell that to the people making 3D movies. Someone get Family Guy creator Seth MacFarlane a Jack on the Rocks. The animated series mogul is also a huge Sinatra fan. If you've got a full orchestra, he'll show up in a tux and belt one out, as he's demonstrated at Carnegie Hall, in London's annual proms, and a nightclub near you. Now the cartoonist turned crooner is making a big band album for Universal. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop? And what is your favorite Sinatra album?
Oh, I can't stand Frank Sinatra.
I don't know that album. Is that a Sinatra?
Oh, God.
It was one of his punk albums. I can't stand Sinatra.
I think this is a big deal. Sad. Oh, God.
Michael?
You mean a big whoop.
Sorry, big whoop. Big whoop.
It's a big whoop, but, you know, having looked at the video, and I've posted some on our YouTube account under favorites, seeing him sing a couple songs, he's got a pleasant voice. He's not a good singer. He sings the melody, not the lyrics, like Frank would have told him to do. But he's not going to embarrass himself, but he's certainly not going to change the world.
Would he sound a little bit like this?
You're the cream in my coffee. You're the salt in my stew. You will always be my necessity. I'd be lost without you. You're the star.
Okay, so before we get a little cease and desist letter, I'll stop that. But that was his performance on the Jay Leno, well, the Tonight Show.
Yeah, that's actually an original tune, or one that he collaborated with on a guy, Joel McNeely, the film score composer. He did a song for the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, which is a good TV series, especially if you have kids.
Oh, it's a great TV series.
Seth MacFarlane heard it and liked it, and they've worked with him to add more lyrics and all that sort of stuff, and that's that song that he was singing right there.
Warner Brothers just got a Dear John letter from best-selling author Nicholas Sparks. The studio is making the novelist's book, The Lucky One, into a feature with Zac Efron circling the starring role. So they thought it was the beginning of a real relationship. Nope. When the movie rights for Sparks' upcoming novel, Safe Haven, came up, Warner Brothers got trumped by Temple Hill, which turned Dear John into a $110 million worldwide success. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Gosh, I guess it's a big deal.
I think it's a big whoop, but really, Nicholas Sparks is like the Stephen King of today. Everything he does gets turned into a movie. It's unbelievable.
Now, Karen, do you remember when we worked at agencies and whether it was Alan Gasmer or whoever it happened to be, whichever agent it was, sending out these spec scripts and these books?
Oh, sure.
And bidding wars would start over them?
Mm-hmm.
That's what this was like. Of course, now it only happens for a Nicholas Sparks novel, but it used to happen every weekend, like clockwork.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember that.
And wasn't there, there was just a time when people would do stunts to try and make their spec script stand out. They'd include a ticking time bomb or, you know, goofy little things. They would, right? The fake time bomb.
Oh, yeah. No, they would. I've been on the other side of that, too, because I worked in development. And no, you'd be so surprised. It's stuff that people send. I used to get candy and all kinds of good stuff.
Well, and by the way, that little ticking time bomb thing was for a movie, a spec script called The Ticking Man, which I think eventually did get made into a movie, or maybe it didn't. I can't
think
remember.
I
remember that, yeah.
I'm going to skip over the listener email this week because we're running a little long on time, and we're going to jump right into Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss only the stories that people in Hollywood might care about. And I know, Michael, you have a story you want to talk about.
It's about Tom Cruise. And the scuttlebutt is about what he's making on Mission Impossible 4, the fourth film in the franchise. And at first, news came out that he was getting scale. And obviously, he'd be getting money in the back end. But as far as his upfront money, how much juice does he have? How much of a star is he? The word was that he was just getting scale. And his people said, no, he's not making scale. Just a, quote, substantially reduced, end quote, upfront payment. So not exactly minimum wage.
We should explain what scale is.
Well, scale is like just a minimum amount you have to pay someone to do a job on a movie set or on a movie or on Broadway. Scale could be anything from $360 for a performance in a background actor on a show to $500. You know, it just varies on who you are and what your role is. But
is about, what is it, Sperling, $6,000 a week?
I think that might be a little high. I mean,
a little high.
These are union rules, so this would be Screen Actors Guild scale.
Right, so this is just the minimum. It's sort of like the minimum wage for an actor. It's like the least you can pay them and still be a legal union shoot. And so it's a very small amount of money. It's like basically he would be doing it for free to make you the money on the back end. And they said, no, he's not doing it for free, but he's getting paid a much reduced amount, which, you know, who knows? It may be like a couple million dollars or $5 million. But for a guy who used to get $20 million a movie, that's a big deal. And so everyone's saying, oh, Tom Cruise is not a star anymore.
Well, do you think he's a star, Michael?
Well, I do. You know, I mean, I was thinking about this. And obviously, if you have power and you have juice, you're going to get more money up front. And so if you have to wait until the back end and you can't get a lot of money up front, that shows a little weakening of power. But on the other hand, if you get first dollar gross or something, who needs up front? You know, what's the point? You're going to get it anyway. But you're saying, I think this is the deal. If you're a person watching Hollywood from the outside and you watch Entertainment Tonight and you read the gossip pages, you think, oh my God, Tom Cruise is in so much trouble. Oh, he's got a weird private life. His movies aren't doing great. He's in a lot of, you know, worry and pain. But in Hollywood, is he still a star? I say absolutely. If you look at his grosses for his movies, just his last five movies, you can see that when this guy flops and does poorly, in a big budget movie, they still gross $200 million worldwide. And to me, that's sort of just like a comfort level. No matter what, you're probably not going to lose your shirt on a Tom Cruise movie. That's the definition of a star. Night and Day, poor reviews. It's at 190 million worldwide. It'll probably hit 200 million. Valkyrie, which is the Nazi drama, clearly not a big action franchise. This is a dour movie with poor reviews, $200 million worldwide. Tropic Thunder, not quite his movie, almost $200 million worldwide. The only movie in the last like 5-10 years that didn't make a lot of money is Lions for Lambs, which is a small little art film by his standards, and he has a secondary role. Vanilla Sky, you go back a decade, this movie was a horribly reviewed movie, $200 million. And the Mission Impossible 2, $550 million, and on and on and on. This is a guy who for the last decade, when everyone says he's been collapsing, is a really consistent moneymaker. Don't you think if you're a Hollywood studio head, you're still very comfortable signing a check for Tom Cruise to be in your big franchise?
I'm going to disagree. I think that he comes under the category of, you know, you don't fire somebody for buying an HP. I think at this point is an icon who is losing his star power. I don't think he's not a star, but I think he's losing his star power. And I think that ever since the Oprah jumping on the couch debacle, he became a joke, and you can't disregard that. He's also getting older, and his star power is definitely waning.
But not at the box office. That's my whole point.
But I don't think you can only judge this by the numbers. You know, this is – it's you have to look at this from a qualitative standpoint as well as quantitative. I mean, numbers, okay, maybe they're not showing a difference, but if you listen to the conversations out there, he is a joke. He is – he's sliding. I mean, do people still go to his movies? Well, yeah, but that's probably more of a statement about how bad some of the movies are. And, you know, when you go see a Tom Cruise movie, you can pretty much depend on what it's going to be.
He's like McDonald's. You know what you're going to get.
But a studio head, isn't a studio head going to say this guy's still a good bet?
No, Sumner Redstone, who owns Viacom, was the person who pushed him off the Paramount lot.
And then begged him to come back again on Mission Impossible 4.
I'm sure he wasn't begging.
I don't know if his production company was – did they beg for the production company to come back? I don't think so. He didn't kick Tom Cruise, the person, off
just
the lot.
Shingle,
I mean, I guess he sort of did, but he pushed the production company off a lot. They weren't making them a lot of money. No, I mean, I think that studio heads, especially some of the younger ones, are going to be more likely to get excited about a Christopher Nolan movie than they are about a Tom Cruise movie.
What's really important about this news is that it finally breaks this $20 million fee for these big mega A-list stars. What it says is A-list stars aren't going to be making the $20 million first dollar gross deals anymore.
Yeah.
But that's all the time we have for the show this week. If you want to subscribe to the show, you can do it on iTunes, or you can do it on the Zune Marketplace, or in the Zune Marketplace, I should say. You can also do it on our website at showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of our social networking accounts, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, all of them, as well as ways to contact us. You can email us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Again, that's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. Not Arcade Fire, FYI. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found in New York, but also on his website, michaelgiltz.com. Michael Giltz is also the username to look up on Twitter if you want to follow him on Twitter. Karen's on Twitter. Her username is @Karen_Woodward. She also has her own website, karenwoodwardonline.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And my Twitter handle is @Sperling. Until next week, play nice.